I'm Floyd Maxwell, justthinker.com, coming to you with the Floydcast, number 34, for October 6, 2014. We are into October of 2014. That's pretty amazing. Time flies. I wanted to clear up a lot of little stories this week because I tried pretty hard, but I can't come up with a big theme, or at least not a big theme that people want to hear about over and over again. Keep it light and friendly and simple and don't solve any problems. That's an old story here. This was a poker story I was watching. This is some months back, but there was a guy playing Tobias Reinkmeyer. He had two aces. You know, it's the strongest first two cards you can get in the game of poker. And he misplayed them so badly at the highest level. This was the highest level tournament there is. It's called One Drop. It's $1 million buy-in, $1 million to play one hand, which, you know, in theory could be your last hand, costs $1 million. Anyway, this guy played two aces, the best cards you can be handed, so badly. He had literally, everyone at the table was literally shaking their heads. I was speechless. Let's look at his name. Tobias, 753, Reinkmeyer, 224, and 977 total. So he's got sevens. He's got seven in the first name, seven destiny. Seven can actually be good, maybe as an expression number in poker, because you don't want to express. The seven sort of hides their expression the best. Now, I'm not recommending anyone have a seven in their name, but a seven expression number definitely hides or holds back or doesn't show what they're feeling. Something that's essential in poker. His last name, 224, well, they say it's not at all constructive. It's not a deep name. It's sort of a muddled name. And he played these cards kind of muddled, kind of like that last name. And then also with the 977 total, 7 destiny. You know, you got a 977 total, you don't want to be playing poker. You want to be out in nature. Also, that 7, you know, it almost makes it. It's almost successful. Well, the way this guy played things at the highest level, it's like, he almost became big, but he showed everybody there. He's like, whoa, what happened to that guy? At the highest level, he's not ready for it. Anyway, just a little random poker story about someone you've never heard of. Probably a tournament you've never heard of. And I'm clearing it off my to-do list. Lucky me. This little story here, I don't even know if I read the link, but the title says, test created to find impurities added to coffee. Well, you know, coffee is really expensive, and they add things to it that aren't coffee. But, of course, we're talking about cheap coffee, right? There was something Maxwell House came out with. I think it was called Morning Blend or something like that. I think the word morning was in there. Well, let me tell you, that word morning should have a U in it, M-O-U-R-N. Because you went into morning if you drank this coffee. It was so bad. We tried some. I don't know why. Ah, dear. Breakfast blend, morning blend. You know, you can avoid worrying about impurities in your coffee. All you have to do is drink a good coffee. I wonder which brand I drink. This was also another old story, just a little bit of humor from our friend Yasiel Puig, we've talked about before. He was at bat. This is admittedly a month old story. And in baseball, if you swing and you miss, they call it a strike. And if you get three of those, you're out. So sometimes you want to check your swing, which means sometimes you want to not swing. You start to swing, you think it's going to be a strike, or you think you can hit it. Then you go, no, I changed my mind. And so you try and stop the bat. Now, the bat is really heavy, and the weight is at the extremity of the end of the bat, so there's a lot of leverage. So trying to check your swing can be, you know, amusing, and at times ineffective, where the bat still crosses the plane. The sort of imaginary plane that makes it a strike. Well, in Mr. Puig's case, the bat did cross the plane because he broke the bat. So he broke the bat by swinging it a little bit and then stopping it with his hands. So he's holding one end of it. He just simply stopped the bat and the rest of the bat kept going. I think you have to be pretty strong to do that. I'm gonna try something new this week. Hopefully it doesn't show up anywhere on the Floydcast, but I'm just going to try and pause this new recorder I've got. Here goes. Alright, now we're resuming. It looked okay in the file. Basically, to pause this new recording, there's no pause button. You press R, which is the record button. And then to stop it, you press R. So it's R to pause it, R to stop it. R would usually be record, right? Anyway. There's a long story about soccer. I want to get to that, but I just want to sort of get something off my chest. I'm just sort of feeling the shadow of war these days. And I was watching a bit of Saving Private Ryan yesterday, and not that much. I mean, I sort of have the movie memorized. It's not that profound a movie on one hand, and on the other hand, it's well done, or parts of it are well done compared to some other war movies. You know, they don't really care about us, and the proof of it is World War I and World War II. There's probably one or two people still alive who were alive, certainly during World War II. You know, that's where they got millions of us to kill each other, while they went around and rearranged things to their benefit. Well, that's going to happen again, without a doubt. And it's going to happen for imaginary reasons, again. You know, just looking at some of the stories on Google News this morning, this ISIS gets mentioned now in the news. And to my mind, this phrase, this four letters abbreviation, just sort of came out of nowhere. And so that makes it 100% suspect to me. Wikipedia says it stands for the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, which sounds like countries. But apparently it's the former name of the Islamic State, which is a jihadist group. Quote, it claims religious authority over all Muslims worldwide, aims to bring most Muslim-inhabited regions of the world under its political control, beginning with territory in the Levant region, which includes Syria, Jordan, Palestine, Lebanon, Cyprus, and part of southern Turkey. So these are all the weakest countries in the world. Is the U.S. really seriously worried about this? So you have some group. I mean, this is like, you know, Bob's jihadist group. Right, this is the weakest countries getting together. Why are they getting together? Well, maybe it's because there's like a massive country supporting another super powerful country that's determined to wipe them off the face of the earth. Could that be it? Do you think that's why a couple of people said, hey, maybe we need to get together? Yeah, it could be that, yeah. But here's the mind bender of the morning. What if ISIS was created by non-Arabs? That is, non-Muslims. This sort of thing is done all the time to incite war. This ISIS thing just, to me, perfectly rings of, let's bring it out of the closet and polish it off and use it to our advantage, somebody said. There's a story this morning, why is Turkey reluctant to fight the Islamic State? Well, first of all, according to that group, part of their territory goes into Turkey, so Turkey, maybe they don't want a civil war? I don't know, just a hazarding a guess there. But maybe the world's most powerful country can do its own dirty work. Maybe that's it. If we think that this ISIS is such a bad thing, why don't we take care of it? The U.S. has something like 500 military bases in the world. You know, probably Turkey has about 500 good fighters in their entire army. 500 people. The U.S. has 500 bases. Let's say the average military base for the U.S. in the world has thousands of people, thousands of pieces of equipment, and access to every single part of the U.S. arsenal. Probably all you need is a phone call. So why is Turkey reluctant? Because Turkey's like, wars cost money, and we don't have any money. And you're trying to get us to waste money on something that you guys could take care of by sort of flicking your finger at it. So it sounds to me like Turkey's being intelligent on this on a couple of fronts. Russia suddenly enters the Ukraine. Well, Russia's been bankrupt for decades, so what's going on there? In my mind, Russia's not doing anything. It sort of reminds me a little bit of North Korea doing a little bit of posturing so that the U.S. would say, oh, please don't do that and throw money at them. So that's one possibility. Another is that, you know, someone with a lot of power is just moving the chess pieces around the board. It's interesting that the Ukraine and Russia are, you know, very highly affiliated countries. And, you know, the history of the last couple hundred years has been take a people in a country, like conquer a country, and then if it has two main groups, separate the two groups, not really in any actual way, just separate them on a piece of paper and say, okay, these two groups are now separate, which is like segregation, right? and in some cases probably like apartheid. And then have the country like, okay, country, you're free to go, and then the country, of course, can't handle it, and there's civil war. So it's, who are we at war with? We're at war with different people each year, kind of thing. So to me, the Russia entering the Ukraine just doesn't make any sense. Again, this came out of nowhere, and it came out of nowhere at the same time that Israel started bombing Palestine again. Israel-Palestine thing is so horrific. I think it's really hard to come up with a way to talk about it. Somebody super powerful throws bombs randomly into populated areas where women and children live. Oh, because it's a threat. Oh, an imaginary threat. There's nothing verified at all. As one person said online, they said there's cartoons. They're actually using in the media cartoons, like made-up graphics, to show the threat that we're bombing. So we're bombing cartoons. But the thing is, the world's not doing anything about what Israel's doing. And so ethnic cleansing is now apparently legal. Or at least legal if Israel does it. And apartheid is now legal, at least if Israel does it. You know, you can learn a lot from reading the news. So it just feels like war is coming. You know, it's like we're in the fall right now and it feels like winter is coming. Well, it feels like war is coming. And yeah, it's bloody depressing. Because they ain't going to be fighting it. It's coming to us all. Tried that magic pause button thing. It seems to be working. It makes for less editing for me afterwards, and I get a more realistic length to the Floydcast so that when I edit it down, they come down to the right size. Because it's all about size. Alright, my soccer update. The headline of the story goes, in 126 years, English football has seen 13,475 nil-nil draws. So this is a story about a guy who has amassed, and I don't even have his name. That's kind of interesting in itself, what his name must be. Because who would do this? Alright, the guy's name is James Curley. Apparently, as part of the story, Mr. Curley, because he was sort of... The site that went and accessed his information is called 538.com. All those three numbers spelled out in its letters. 538.com has really been great. I just sort of discovered them, thanks to ESPN, and in the last few months. And they're super analytical. So this guy has amassed, I don't know how he did it, but from many sources he tapped into, he has now got records, like a database of every game. I don't know if it's just the score of every game. Sort of working it out in my head. He's got about a 1,000 bytes of information per game. So 1,000 bytes is about 150 words. So he's probably got more than just he's got who scored in each game. And so let's look at his name first, James Curley. James 663. Curley, 843, because it's C-U-R-L-E-Y. 843 and a 516 total. Well, six destiny, you know, this is definitely the work of someone with an even destiny, first of all. Because this guy, 188,000 games is what he's entered into his database. That's astounding. You have to have some real persistence to do that. But James, most Jameses go by Jim. So it's Jim Curley, 955-843-898 total. 8 destiny. Well, the 8 is even more of an accomplishing destiny than the 6. And with that combination, that really speaks to this guy, I think. So this is sort of like an ultimate reference point. But the headline of the story immediately talks about how many nil-nil draws there have been, which means a soccer game where nobody scored. That's what that means. And almost 10% of the time, I think it's about 7% of the time, nobody scores. You have a game, nobody scores. Well, let me ask you, if you're looking at the highlights of that game, what are you looking at? There's no goals. I've just sort of partially quoted from this article. It's hard not to quote the whole thing. In these 188,000 games, the final score most commonly was 1-0. And this was proof for the researcher that soccer was as low scoring as he suspected. The 1-0 score happened in 30,000 games over the last 126 years. So that's roughly 300 games a year end in 1-0. There's a total of 1 score. Let's take football. Football is probably averages, I'm going to estimate, 6 or 7 scores per game. So 6 or 7 scores versus 1. That's what I get from that. Other common scores, 2-1. So a 1-goal game. A 1-goal victory. 27, that happened 27,000 games, so more than 10% of the time, 2-1. And another common score was 2-0, happened 22,000 times, and 1-1, so a tie at 1-1, 22,000 times. In half the games, for the last 126 years, at least one of the teams, quote, forgot to score at all. That led Curley to an answer for one of his questions. Soccer is a bit dull, he says. Well, you know, that's sort of my thesis. That's why I did my soccer bit, was how unwatchable soccer was and how, yeah, among other things, dull it is. You know, they call it the beautiful game, but here's the actual numbers, the actual research saying it's a dull game. Well, you can't have dull and beautiful in the same sentence. You cannot do that. So this beautiful game, that's just made up. That's just a falsehood. By the way, draws in general, ties in general, 47,000. More than one in every four games is a tie. So you go there to see who's the better team, and you come away, it's a tie. Quote, in another testament to the sport's dullness, draws have become more common over history. Last season, 27% of games ended without a winner. Quote, as English soccer has wound its way through the decades, its scoring has withered. Well, this is my whole point about soccer, is that there's not enough scoring. There's too much violence against the good players. And it's all because soccer's afraid to change the rules. Well, this article then talks about that. I guess there used to be, before 1925, there used to be a really bizarre aspect of the offside rule. Right now, basically, the ball always has to be the first thing down the field in a pass. You can't be behind the defenders when the ball is coming to you, currently. But it used to be that three players had to be between an attacker and the goal. So it used to be that there had to be three players on the other team between you and the goal. Now it's just one. I hope I've got all that right. I think I did. This got changed in 1925 so that two players are needed. Oh, I see. Typically a defender and the goalkeeper. I see. Giving more leeway to attackers. So technically they still have two, but the goalie's one of them. Well, the goalie's always back, right? So just, you know, typical of soccer's strangeness. The reasons for the other big shifts are less clear. Rule changes, the kind of things that would usually explain variation in goals, are quite rare in soccer's history. Well, this is exactly the problem. There are almost no rule changes. In 1958, substitutions were allowed for the first time. So if you can believe it, in, say, 1950, you couldn't substitute off players in a soccer game. You couldn't have one guy leave and a new guy take his place. This is so common in, well, it's common in every other sport, every other team sport, certainly. The only time it's not common is if you're playing an individual sport. Let's say you're playing tennis. You're the only guy on your team, right? If you get injured, well, the game's over. You have to forfeit. But in team games, changing players is routine. In volleyball, there's a rotation. And you rotate around the floor in a fixed manner, and then part of your rotation is you go on the bench. It's just routine. Soccer limits it today to three substitutions. Why? I don't know. That substitution thing is a total mystery to me. And as I point out in my article, like, now that you have the risk of getting a concussion, you can't afford to take chances with players. And in football right now, they have a protocol to follow. They get you over to the sideline. The game continues, but you have doctors examining you to see if you've got a concussion. Well, you know, it won't surprise me if at some point down the road they'll find out, if they'll admit that just heading the ball is very hard on your brain. And the thing about a concussion, or if you've had one, a mild concussion even, is that you've damaged your brain, and one of the things you immediately have to do is not further damage it until it heals. Well, heading the ball alone would damage your brain if you had already had a mild concussion. All of this points toward you need to have substitutions unlimited. Why doesn't soccer have them? The interesting thing in this article, because they want to look at it, when you introduced substitutions, did it change the scoring? And bottom line, it corresponded to the beginning of a steep decline in scoring, so it actually caused a reduction in scoring to introduce fresh players. Quote, perhaps playing with an injured player left teams extremely vulnerable on defense, leading to goals. Well, this again shows the flaw of soccer. Soccer does everything backwards, and this is more of it. They're saying you need to be tired for there to be goals. Like I talked about in my article, I don't want to watch tired players. You got to restructure the game where you protect the good players. Okay, other rule changes. The introduction of red and yellow cards in 1970. So prior to 1970, you couldn't get kicked out of a game. You couldn't even get the precursor of the yellow card. Well, I talk about how soccer has missing tiers, rungs on the ladder. They don't have enough different types of penalties. And that includes the red and yellow. Even then, it's not enough. And there's too big of a gap between a free kick, which is basically a non-consequence. Here's the ball back. And a yellow card, don't do that again. You've been warned. If you do, you'll be kicked out of the game. Huge consequence. They need penalties. They need penalties just like hockey has. Timeouts, basically. Rugby has this. Rugby changed? Why can't soccer? I just don't understand this. Another tweak to the offside rule in 1990 banned goalkeepers' handling of the back passes in 1992. I didn't know it was that long ago, but basically what that says is, used to be you could kick the ball back to the goalie and the goalie could pick it up. Well, when the goalie picks up the ball, no one on the field except that goalie can do anything. You're not allowed to make physical contact with the goalie, and so you're basically just waiting for him to do something with the ball. Well, he can stand there all day. The game just stopped being soccer as soon as he picks up that ball. And it was routine for teams that were supposed to be going forward to pass the ball back to the goalie all the time. And, you know, the crowd would hiss. A whistle is a negative thing in Europe. And that's all you could do. You know, you'd protest, but so what? In 1992, they made it illegal to do that, which is why now you'll see some on YouTube, you'll see some, you know, fails, some egregious mistakes where they kick the ball back to the goalie and he tries to kick it instead of picking it up and misses, and then the ball promptly goes in its own goal. Another change they made in 1981, it used to be that when you won a game, you got 2 points, and they changed it in 1981 to give you 3 points. And they thought what this would make happen is that you wanted to win more badly, because of course there used to be a lot of ties. But they say, the analysis website, 538.com, says, this change gave teams less incentive to settle for a draw. This could have led to more aggressive play and more goals. However, the effect may not operate in just one direction. In other words, once a team does score, that team has all the more incentive to shut the game down and hold out to win, having scored just one goal. So if you score your one goal, and now you're going to get your 3 points for the win, and then how do they shut the game down? And of course, this is the real problem with soccer. You shut the game down by being physical. Soccer doesn't have the proper penalty system to deal with one team being physical. Like not playing soccer, but physically assaulting the other team. Soccer just doesn't have a way of coping with that. You will see referees literally talking to players and warning them. You don't see that in football. You never see an official warning a player in football. It never happens. You do something wrong, you get a foul. You do something really wrong, you get kicked out of the game. No discussion at all. Soccer, literally you see referees wagging their finger at a player. This is a sign that your sport is hopelessly, pathetically designed. Change it. It's embarrassing. Soccer is the embarrassing game. Ah, dear. Anyway, an interesting story, but it points precisely to the fact that soccer is dull, not enough scoring, and shutting the game down. Yeah, it's physically assaultive and not enough penalties. You know, I had to fit in a soccer story once in a while, right? Well, you know, I did send an email to them after I did my article. I did send an email to the 538 people and said I thought I had a few points to make. Or I forget why I emailed them. But, you know, the guy just has a contact email at the end of each article. I thought I'd give it a shot. And who knows, maybe that prompted them to research things. And seems like I'm on track there. All right, little change of pace here. There's a lady, Ellen Pompeo. I hope that's how you pronounce it. The story said she welcomes a daughter via surrogacy, and she shares an adorable photo. Isn't that wonderful? Well, wait a minute. Let's get to the real crux of the article, surrogacy. I'm not going to say, you know, whether it's good or bad. Basically, surrogacy is someone else has your child. Is it really yours? I guess it might be her seed. I didn't read that much detail, but your husband's seed and your egg, and then it gets put in someone else, and they raise the baby to term and birth the baby, and then the baby is handed back to you. Anyway, why did this person have trouble with childbirth? Well, let's look at the name. Pompeo is an 898. When a woman has the 8 quality in their name, they will have trouble with childbirth. It's just an accepted fact of the numbers. By the way, while we're at it, I didn't even look at this earlier. Ellen Pompeo's husband, Chris Ivory, Chris 933, but also Christopher 224, not at all constructive. Ivory, Ivery, 527, accident looking for a place to happen. Well, well, and a one destiny, hell for a total. Chris Ivory has a hell for a total. Well, honestly, I don't doubt that because I don't care for this Ellen Pompeo character. I don't see what she's got at all. Anyway, so this is, I guess, Ellen's second daughter by surrogacy. In the story it says, the actress, who already has a daughter with husband Chris Ivory, seems extremely excited about her new bundle of joy. And of course the press could care less. But what they like is, it's a surrogacy story. They want something new, something different, something controversial, right? They always want that. They couldn't possibly care less about healthy, normal babies. That's the last thing they want to hear. So just for them to say that, it's just so sleazy and so dishonest. So there you have it. If you want to have trouble with childbirth, you're a lady, make sure you got the A quality in your name. Conversely, if you don't want that, you need to find out if you have the A quality in your name. Each position, there's one chance in nine of having the A quality. There's six positions, so there's six chances in nine that you have the A quality. And if you have a nickname, well, that's two more positions. You're almost at 100% chance of having it, at least one place. You know, Pompeo is 898, is an extremely strong dose of it. You know, you can't get a higher amount of it. So there's someone that has completely given up, right? They have no choice. They've completely given up the process and they're just letting someone else raise their child for them. Or raise their growth, technically. There's a story you may recall some months back, a bicep 2 study out of Antarctica. This was like supposedly getting proof of everything, of inflation, Big Bang, and some other nonsense. I remember when the story came out, my response, which I read into a Floydcast, was, I doubt it. And apparently they had announced, at the same time as the story, they'd announced tweaks to kind of like squeeze their story in. And then there were like very distinguished kind of physics types who came out and said, hey, no, I don't think so. And it sort of disappeared as a story because like no one, certainly it hasn't gotten stronger as a story. Well, September 30, so this is just this last week. Story headline, the risks of blowing your own trumpet too soon on research. Did they ever? Oh, how the mighty have fallen. Interesting, bicep 2. 551 total. So, same combination as hell. That's what this research body is working under. You know, the name of what you work under has an impact. That's the company that you work under, the project that you come up with. It all has an impact. You know, Windows is a super successful combination. You know, isn't it amazing how a big corporation managed to copyright Windows so no one else can come up with Windows, even though normally, if the word is in the dictionary, you can't copyright it. Isn't it amazing how powerful these big companies have become? Alright, back to football, only this time, North American football. Story headline, Ken Burrell Tompkins waived by Pats. So this is the New England Patriots, or Pats. Wide receiver Ken Burrell Thompson, one of the feel-good stories for the New England Patriots in 2013, as he rose from undrafted rookie free agent to frontline contributor, he was waived by the team Saturday, which means we don't want him, basically. It seems like the person writing the story is Mike Reese, R-E-I-S-S, 527, accent looking for a place to happen. Oh, dear. Tompkins started in the season opener, blah, blah, blah. Was inactive for two of the last three games as he was passed on the depth chart by five-year veteran Brandon LaFell. While the Patriots made the surprising move, they didn't activate veteran cornerback Brandon Browner or receiver Brian Times. Okay, we now have all the names I want to talk about. So, Ken Burrell Tompkins was let go. Let's look at his name. Ken Burrell, 167. Nothing wrong there. Tompkins, 628. Fantastic name. Total, 786. Six destiny. This guy's awesome. So he was traded by the Pats. Okay. He was basically sort of replaced by this Brandon LaFell. Brandon, 775, accident looking for a place to happen. And this guy was kept by the Pats. And then the other two names mentioned in the story, Brandon Browner. Well, Brandon again, 775. Browner, 235, and a one destiny. Finally, by Brian Times, Ryan 178 is fine, it's good, times 775. So the three alternatives that the Patriots decided to keep, every one of them has a 775, and the guy they passed on had really basically nothing but good qualities in his name. By the way, the Patriots are having the worst start to their season that I've ever seen. I even saw talk this last week about the quarterback Tom Brady. Is it time to look at a replacement? Well, I think, by the way, it is, because Brady's getting old. Simple as that. These days, a quarterback's a formula. There's so much constraint to what a quarterback can do. You know, you're a passing machine. You're like the queen in the hive. All the queen does is lay eggs, and they bring the queen food, and the queen can, especially with ant colonies, the queen can become enormous and just nonstop produces eggs. That's all the queen does. Well, you know, the quarterback in NFL is a bit like that. These days, the linemen, the people on the other team who rush you, they are so fast, their pursuit is so fast that you have to get rid of the ball quickly. That's it. That's the strategy. So you either hand it off quickly or you pass it quickly. Peyton Manning, who's so phenomenal, one of the things he does so great, I mean, there are a number of them, but one of the things he does so great is he passes the ball super fast. So, you know, you can teach this to a quarterback. I don't think there's all that much sacred about a quarterback, honestly. You just have to recruit a good one, and especially a young one. I don't want to be too hard on Tom Brady. I mean, he has a good name, and relatively speaking, and I'm sure he's fine. But isn't it interesting that they've made all the wrong choices with receivers, and there they are having their worst season yet? Okay, now here's the story of a good Brandon. You don't have to be a bad, you know, Brandon 775 doesn't have to be a bad name. Who am I kidding? Anyway, occasionally, a Brandon can do something good. Last night in a baseball game, the winning home run was belted by Brandon Belt. Belt is 573, so you have 775, 573, 358 total, 8 destiny. Well, it's interesting that, you know, really this guy's destiny did the talking, right? You know, we talked about Puig is 358. This guy has the Puig total, or Puig as his total. Story yesterday, gives you an idea how desperate I am for stories at the moment. This is the first weekend in America with no Saturday morning cartoons. First time in 50 plus years. Apparently, NBC ditched Saturday morning cartoons in 1992, 20 years ago. And CBS not long after that. ABC ditched them in 2004, 10 years ago. So the lone holdout in the lower channels was the CW. A lower-tier broadcast network was the last holdout in a game that the big three left long ago. What killed Saturday morning cartoons, cable streaming, and the FCC? Well, I guess the FCC requires a certain amount of child content, and so they decided to switch to more educational content. I don't think that's it. Cable. Well, cable's been around 60 years, so it can't be cable. So the only thing left is streaming. Then the article talks about streaming a little bit, and they say Netflix, Hulu, and the like. What's interesting in this article is they don't mention YouTube. Gizmodo, where this article was, doesn't mention YouTube. You know, maybe Gizmodo's worried about competition. Because YouTube is one of these places, talk about a sticky website. You know, one of the things websites want to be is sticky. Meaning you go there and you find something interesting and then you search around and you find a bunch more stuff that's interesting. And you kind of stay there a while. You could argue that Facebook is sticky. I think Facebook is sticky in the worst sense of that word. You know, the tar pits. Facebook is the tar pits. But YouTube is like going to a really interesting market. Or maybe the largest mall in the world. Every store is something new, something different, right? Oh, the irony. In this story, they had an animated GIF. So it's an animated sequence of pictures. Which looks like a movie, but it's really just pictures. Some mindless little animation. And they got it from YouTube. They even had to give credit to YouTube in the bottom of the story. So, YouTube wins. Cartoons lose. You know, I have to say, if you've got to choose between YouTube and cartoons, I think YouTube is a much better choice. But also, unfortunately, more addictive. Alright, a couple of health-related stories. There was one about the sense of smell may predict lifespan. Basically saying that when you start to lose your sense of smell, you're going to be dead in 5 years. That's in essence what the story was saying. And then people on Slashdot talked about it, which made it, you know, more interesting because they bring other things to the table instead of a sensationalist headline. One guy said, Our sense of smell is the sense running at the lowest level. It's wired straight into the brain in the shortest path of any sense. That's why apparently there's a peanut butter test, smell test, to diagnose Alzheimer's. And that I thought was quite interesting. There was another Slashdot comment, which is much longer. Basically, he's talking about the tip of the olfactory nerve. That's the only part of the human nervous system that's continuously regenerated by stem cells. And then he says that's a bit misleading or even untrue. He goes on to totally elaborate, and I'll have the link, but the tip of the olfactory nerve is the olfactory epithelium, where the olfactory sensory receptor cells are located, and he gets into all kinds of detail. What's interesting is, this Slashdot comment, and I'm just estimating it might be 100, 200 words, is larger than the Wikipedia page on the olfactory nerve. Now, isn't that kind of weird? It just doesn't normally go that way. When I was doing one of my COSALT talks, physics talks, and I was pointing out that there was two pages on gravity and they were both identical, even though they were supposed to be different subjects and they're basically identical. And they're quite large. They were 6,000 words. Well, this one on the olfactory nerve was like 500 words. Wikipedia is really quite weird. There was some phenomenon, physics phenomenon, that's been around, been observed for like over 50 years, and it had no Wikipedia page. I think it was one, I'm just going to go by memory and try and remember what it was. I think it was one where when you dampened down everything, some things got louder. In essence, you detected some super loud anomalies. But the point is that why is Wikipedia so inconsistent in their coverage of stories? Of course, you know, it's manned by people and they have agendas. But Wikipedia is really weird. You could take probably any reality show person, just about. They'll be mentioned in Wikipedia. But you could take Tom Hopkins, who's a famous guy in the sales business. How to Master the Art of Selling was his famous book. And there's no entry in Wikipedia for Tom Hopkins. I just don't get that. What is your criteria? You know, part of it is Wikipedia is so enormous that you have to distribute the management of Wikipedia. But, you know, you can automate mechanisms to fix things. Like one of the examples of Wikipedia is someone changes a page and corrects something, and then you get these now bots, robots, automatic programs that will automatically revert the page. And you get people that will automatically reject stuff, even when the stuff is submitted exactly in accordance with the Wikipedia criteria. You just get people that they want it a certain way and they're not going to tolerate it otherwise. You know, if you read about fluoridation, trust me, that's what's going on there. They want the story to read a certain way and that's that. Same with microwave radiation. You have to really search, but if you do search hard on at least one of the Wikipedia pages, you'll see that it's possibly carcinogenic. They come on right out and say that. Well, possibly carcinogenic at one dose is carcinogenic at another dose. You could take water. Water is possibly harmful. And then you get blasted with 50 fire hoses from 2 feet away. It's going to be very harmful. You'd be lucky to survive. Anyway. There's a Wikipedia ramble for you. The other story was, loose e-cigarette laws may be hard to tighten. Well, this is kind of weird stuff, too. E-cigarettes have been sold since 2007, but the FDA has yet to regulate them. Why? I guess e-cigarettes first were sold 7 years ago, and the FDA, for some reason, didn't rule on whether it was legal to sell them. So that in itself is like, what? The crazier thing is, they didn't like rule on it a year later, or 2 years later, or 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 7. They have not regulated e-cigarettes. Nicotine is one of the most deadly drugs. It's actually deadly. Like, if you take pure nicotine, a drop of it, the smallest drop you can make is sort of tar-like. On your fingernail is where they usually describe it, like the size of the head of a pin, is enough to kill you. You see those guys with nicotine stains on their fingers? That nicotine in itself is toxic. So you have a device that can now let kids use it, and you don't regulate it at all. So my comment is, it's crystal clear what's going on here. The big boys are creating a market for e-cigarettes. They're just getting them out there, unregulated, get people addicted, and then, oh yeah, years later, we'll regulate it. And of course, by that time, everyone's addicted, and the regulations won't work. They'll be meaningless regulations. In a related note, there was a case that I heard of just recently in a school where in class, a student was huffing on an e-cigarette in class. Now that's pretty daring. But this is what happens when something's not regulated. You gotta be kidding me. Now, I have a feeling if that kid was shooting up heroin, that would probably be bad, right? Oh, I know something to be even worse. If that kid was smoking pot in class. And by the way, what's next? Hacking the cigarette thing so that you can inhale pot in class. What a nightmare. What a nightmare. And this is deliberate. Let's be clear. This is deliberately created. This is one of the next markets they want to be huge. Create the addicts, and then you've got the market. All right, my random factoid of the week. Guess what the number one category of person that is followed on Twitter is? Singers. Like a singer in a band, musical singer. I was just astounded by that. I mean, first of all, lyrics, it's like poetry. I've never been a fan of poets and poems because you either have something to say and say it, or you get fancy. You start worrying about how does it look, not what's the actual content. Style over substance. A poem is style over substance. Well, singing, it's just a poem plus music, right? Style over substance. And, of course, modern singers and modern songs, usually the lyrics are horrendous. There was a time when there was inspiration associated with music. In other words, there might be some good quotes in a song, some good thoughts in a song. Now you're lucky if the song doesn't have the beeps accompanying it to beep out the swear words. But apparently those are okay as long as it's rap music. So why would we follow singers? Now, of course, you know, I don't have any respect for Twitter. And this, you know, just, you know, confirms that. But why are we following singers? And maybe what it says is the music business is highly manipulated, highly controlled, and they choose who becomes successful. And they want publicity for their singers. So they're big into Twitter because it's a way to promote their singer. Maybe that's what that's really saying. And then the followers, well, followers are followers, right? They get led around by other people, right? But it just seemed really bizarre and really backwards. Singers are the number one category on Twitter. I don't understand it. There's an interesting story here. A fired Fed regulator releases 47 hours of meeting recordings with Goldman Sachs. Quote, in one meeting, a Goldman employee expressed a view that once clients are wealthy enough, certain consumer laws don't apply to them. After that meeting, this guy turned to a fellow Fed regulator, I guess the whistleblower, Cigar, turned to a fellow Fed regulator and said how surprised she was by that statement. So it's not a guy. To which the regulator replied, you didn't hear that. But anyway, just, you know, these big companies being above the law. The person becoming the whistleblower, Cigar, 786, Six Destiny. You know, it's a fine quality, the 786. The 7 has the depth and can operate in secret, right? Because if you're releasing 47 hours of meetings, you've recorded them, you've absconded with it, you've surreptitiously recorded, and you had to be secretive to do it. And then the 6, you know, cares, right? This is wrong, right? These big companies doing what they're doing these days, it's all wrong. Update on Tracy Morgan. This was the comedian, I guess, who was traveling with a bunch of comedians in a limousine, and a Walmart driver hit them, causing a serious accident to the limo on the highway. And it turned out the Walmart guy, he had to drive 700 miles to get to the Walmart distribution center to pick up his load and then begin his shift. So he had to drive 700 miles before his shift started, something like that. And so Mr. Morgan, I first mentioned it because how do you get into an accident in a limo? How often does that happen? Well, you have to have a name like Morgan 775, right? Accident looking for a place to happen, and a 9 Destiny in this guy's case. Well, it turns out now they've ruled that Tracy Morgan could have prevented the injuries he sustained during an accident in June if he had worn a seatbelt. Walmart is making this claim in their legal paperwork. Well, you know, they're right. You know, this is a crazy thing about limos. What was that limo doing on the highway? A limo is like a room on wheels. Does a room lend itself to people sitting in seats and wearing seatbelts? The more you sort of look into the story, the more kind of bizarre it all is, right? And just how everything came together in a bad way. This is a story here. Joseph Foria hurt chasing puppy. This is a football player. Joseph Foria, Joseph 281, Foria, F-A-U-R-I-A, 562. 753 total, 3 Destiny. You know, fortunate but not stable. Shouldn't be a problem, right? Well, how many Josephs do you know that go by Joseph? They go by Joe, right? So Joe Foria, 213 for Joe, Foria 562, 775 total. Accident looking for a place to happen. He injures himself chasing a puppy. Speaking of 775, Amal Alamuddin is George Clooney's new wife. Amal 279. Amuddin 527. Accident looking for a place to happen. 797 total. Well, the most sensitive numbers are the 2, the 5, the 7, and the 9. Well, that's all she has in her name. The 7 doesn't want to be around people. She has it in her family name, and she has a 797 total. 279 is super emotional. One of the most common names is Oliver, but also Jones. Very emotional names. Wow. Normally when someone gets married, I like George Clooney. You think good luck, sort of comes to mind. Well, that name is not going to bring good luck. They cannot do that. An update on the John Crawford story, another Walmart story. This is the guy who was shot in a Walmart while he was trying to buy a gun that Walmart sold and sells. Quote, "Despite store surveillance footage that showed a young black man, i.e. John Crawford III, casually talking on his cell phone and clearly not threatening other shoppers in an Ohio Walmart store when he was shot and killed, a grand jury on Wednesday announced it would not indict the police officer, Sean Williams, for firing on the man. Guilty of being black. You're black and you have a gun in a store, you must be a murderer, right? Whoops, the store sells the gun." Oh, dear. All right, a couple more stories and I'm going to get to my of the weeks. Okay, I got a little rant about reachability. Why don't people reply to our emails? This is sort of one of the things I notice because I've had a website for a long time and I reply to other people when they send me emails. The only exception to this one, by the way, is when you get stalkers. I have 6,000 subscribers, and over the years I've had one or two people that will just keep sending you their random thoughts, their lunatic thoughts. And I might reply once or twice, politely, and then after a while you just don't reply to them. They get filtered into the bit bucket in the sky, as they say. But for most people, what does it take to reply to someone? Let's say someone's asking you a standard question. So you're some pseudo famous or famous person, and you're Cindy Crawford, and they're saying, "How did you get that mole?" or "Why did you get that mole removed?" So you come up with an explanation. "Well, honey, I've made a lot of money from my mole." And then you save that as a file, as canned text. And when you get those emails, you just reply and you paste that canned text in there and you send it back. That's not so hard to do. Now, I'm giving a frivolous example, but let's say you're a physicist and people are going to send you questions and send you their crazy spring loop theories. And why don't you reply? The really bizarre thing is, it would be different if physics made sense these days, but it doesn't. There are four main forces in life. According to modern physics, they accept that. They theorize there might be five. I think there's more likely three, by the way. In the nucleus, gravity is involved more than plus attracting minus in the nucleus. So I'm not convinced. There's a strong force for sure. There's an EM force. I guess there is four. Okay, thinking out loud. But there's a slight rearrangement of the forces in my book, anyway. Well, the point is, we don't even understand what gravity is. So it's like we're building a house and we have hammers, nails, wood, and glass. And we don't even understand what wood is. How can we do that? And the point is, if someone comes along and goes, "I got a new theory about wood," aren't we curious when we don't understand it? I haven't sent a lot of emails, but occasionally, to guys I respect, guys I think have, put some thought into their field, not just puppeting what everyone else is saying. And I contact them and tell them about my theory, and I don't hear back. This goes in any territory, right? What do you expect them to do, kind of thing. But as I say, there are many ways that they could reply back. Method number one, have some canned text. "Sorry, I don't reply." You could say, "It seems like you have a theory. Thanks for sending it to me. Just to let you know, I don't have time to read everyone's theories, and good luck to you." The person could send that back. And they could do that the first time, and because it says they're not going to reply, they don't have time to read it, and then if you send them another one, they can ignore the second one. That seems like a courteous, simple thing to do. They could have, a couple of other canned text variations. One of them could be, okay, I've looked at your theory and I can't point at any one thing and say that's obviously wrong, so you might be right. I just don't have time to look into it further. Thanks for writing to me. I can't, reply further on this. If you email me again, I won't reply. You send that off. You won't hear from them again. Or if you do, you can just delete them, right? Put it into your filters if you have to and filter right to your junk file. The point is, these people have contact information. They have ways to contact them on the internet. But then when you contact them, they ignore you. You don't get any reply back at all. I truly do not understand that. There was a guy locally I went to see. He's at a local college. And I just dropped in on this guy. Hang on, Pete. I just dropped in on this guy. I went to his office and just asked them in the office, where is his office? And they told me. And they told me what his office hours were, and I went there at that time. And I said, I've got a theory. And he's like, oh, well, send me an email. So I sent him an email. So this is the guy asking me to send him an email. I send him an email, I get nothing back. It's not that I expect instant gratification, or instant recognition or anything. But if someone, you're looking face to face, and someone says, this is like a professional to a professional. I mean, I'm a chemical engineer. And I tell the guy, I'm a chemical engineer, and I got a theory of physics. And he's a physics guy at a college. So this is one professional to another saying, hey, I've got something. And the guy says, send me an email. And you send him an email, and then you don't hear anything back. Recently, I've been listening to some of the Joe Rogan Experience, this prolific podcaster. I've looked on his sites, and other than, Twitter, Facebook, which I consider just garbage, I almost said them all in the same sentence, Twitter, Facebook, garbage. I don't see any way of contacting this guy. Again, why is that? I mean, if you have a podcast and you want to get interesting people on your podcast, why wouldn't you have a submission form? Contact us, right? Yeah, okay, you can have someone else, manage that, and you can have them do the automatic replies. We've received your submission, and if we find it interesting, we'll contact you in the future. Why don't they have something like that? Instead, they have nothing. I think one of the arguments is spam related. Well, my website is being hosted by just a very average company, and I get almost no spam. It's so little, it's like it's a hint that reminds you we used to have a spam problem. Spam is not a problem these days. Yahoo? I have my own website and address, email address, and I have my Yahoo account email. The Yahoo one gets a lot of spam, hundreds, probably, 50 a day or something, and they all go to the spam folder, all of them. All of them, without exception. Occasionally, I will force myself to go to the spam folder because once in a blue moon, once in, 5,000 emails, 10,000 emails, they misfilter and they put something that shouldn't be spam, they put it in the spam folder. And I have, it's rare. It might be once a year kind of an occurrence. So just to be thorough, right, in case someone has contacted me and I missed it, I go and look, I dig through the trash, I dig through my spam folder to see if someone emailed me. I just don't understand why physics profs... I mean, how many emails is a physics prof getting? Is he getting 1,000 a day from rabid fans? I'd be surprised if he's getting 10 a day from fans. You can go through 10 emails. Somebody can go through. You can set up a filter. You have a publicly available email address, and that can be specifically go to a filtering mechanism. Your department could have a filtering mechanism. This is run by somebody else, and it's an automatic reply when they contact this address. Thank you for contacting me. This is an automated response. I don't have time to look at your email. If it's urgent, contact the department head. Here's the phone number. Or if it's, you can redirect them to other avenues. I mean, when you buy something on Amazon or other websites, you get an automatic email confirmation, right? And you can't reply to that, but it gives you contact information. If you need to change your order, you can log into your account by clicking here type thing. There's just a certain amount of common courtesy, and without it, there's a certain amount of fakeness to these people. And this physicist, especially this local guy, he seems like a pretender to me. He's got his powerful position, his lucrative position. A new theory would threaten him. That's all you can take away from it. He has nothing to gain by a new theory. Financially, he's already making the maximum, right? He's a tenured professor or whatever. His mind is truly shut. It's pathetic. But as to Joe Rogan, I don't understand it. With a lot of these types, they, and I've seen other sites where they come out and say it, they'll say, we will never act on a submission. If you submit something to us, we will specifically never use that. I know where I've seen this is with charities, with, you know, like scholarships and that kind of thing. And they make it explicit that they only support the things that they seek out and they find and they decide on. And if you submit something, they will never use that. Again, I don't agree with that, but at least they're telling you that's the case. You know, with these sites where you can't contact them or they give you a way to contact them and then they ignore it, you know, they're just being two-faced about it. It's just very unprofessional. I just don't understand it. There's a laziness there. And there's like some excuses going on that don't have any basis. You know, with my physics thing, I consider my spring loop theory, I consider it a 100-year project. You know, it's going to take maybe 3-5 years before I've fleshed out everything I can come up with using my lens, the spring and loop theory lens, unique way of looking at the world. And then I'll have it in writing. But how long does it take before something gets accepted? Nowadays, there's obviously a cacophony of voices, cacophony of sounds, cacophony of websites, like the Facebooks and the Twitters and the YouTubes, where people can... There was one guy on Slashdot who started to show his contempt for YouTube, I guess. Every time he has lunch, he turns on his camera, I think it's at work, and he records himself eating lunch. He doesn't say a word, and all he does is he has a sandwich, he just eats a sandwich, and then he makes it into a YouTube. You know, so that's called dilution. You know, everything's getting diluted. So, you know, when the internet first happened, and especially when you had AltaVista, the first good search engine, you could then find good stuff. You typed in what you wanted to find, and you could find it. Then Google came along, and, you know, AltaVista sort of deteriorated a bit, and then Google came along, and it was even more pure, right? Instead of having other links on the homepage, on the main page of Google, there's just the Google search, right? And it seemed great. And then you get AdWords, and if you look at the Google interface now, it's pretty cluttered. There's a lot of not-what-I-wanted stuff going on there. They call it PageRank. Google ranks a page, and Google decides which page they're going to serve you. It's no longer based on, well, this one had the most hits or anything like that. It's a formula, and it can be tweaked and changed, and it can be censorship, it can be bias, it can be anything now. So how do you get a message out, even if it's a good message? If your message is that fluoride is bad, stop drinking it, how do you get that message out? It takes time. That's the answer. They've been fighting fluoride ever since it was introduced 60 years ago, and they're getting close. I think they're getting close. You know, the very biggest of big boys want fluoride to happen. They don't want 7 billion people on this planet. They want to whittle us down to 500 million, so they're going to have to kill us off. I think we made progress on the fluoride front simply because they've got microwave radiation now. It's much more effective. It's going to kill us off way better. And people are going to be dosing themselves so that when we all look back on it, we'll be like, wow, we did it to ourselves. Can you believe that? So even if I have a good theory of physics, it's going to take a while. I mean, it took Einstein 30 years before it was sort of generally accepted. Supposedly, Einstein's theory needed, you know, proof, the old, you know, eclipse thing. That's, I mean, sort of questioned that whole storyline. It was one of the stages of his theory becoming accepted. Well, I've come up with some testable components of my theory, and we'll see if they materialize or see if they get mentioned, but it takes a while. Good things take a while. Bad things happen immediately. All right. Of the weeks. Bad driver of the week. This was a story slightly out of date now. It looks like it's from a month ago. Daylight savings time and accidents. This is from CBSLocal.com. The Monday after daylight savings time is one of the deadliest days on the road, with a 17% increase in fatalities. Well, again, you know, what is daylight savings time, right? It's Big Brother. Get used to it. Big Brother's here and we're going to push you around. That's all that daylight savings time is. You can't say it. You can't justify it. We started it. We want you to get used to it so that we can introduce more Big Brother, right? That's how they work. They have all the money, so they have all the patience. They can take decades to do things. So that was like a bad driver, right? 17% more accidents in that one day. How many people does that translate to? You know, daylight savings time kills. That's what that story is really saying. Re-listen of the week? I don't really have a re-listen of the week this week. I did listen to a variety of different things and watched a variety of different things, but I didn't make a note of anything. Reread of the week, or read of the week. I've been reading Kenneth W. Ford's 101 Quantum Questions. With many physics books, most, the majority, when I read them now, I just end up seeing the flaws. Because physics is built on sort of a house of cards, where, you know, you have things like a Big Bang and inflation and all this rubbish, you can't make viable theories based on that. And so when you try, you quickly, you know, get into hot water. You quickly start talking nonsense. And so most people, most physicists are doing this. But some are genuinely, you know, trying to sort things out and genuinely trying to deal with some of the flaws in physics. Well, it turns out this Kenneth Ford guy is trying to do that. And he's really laying out the field, the quantum field, really well. So I read a little bit on each week on this from this guy. And, you know, in the early stages of the article, it was nothing special. I've been making notes. I've got 8 or 10 pages of detailed notes. And lately, it's really getting down into an area where it's helping me with my theory, bottom line. My theory started out as just being a way to explain gravity. Then it came up with the realization that all of space is springs or energy. You know, that's not totally new. It's predicted by even, you know, regular physics, but they can't detect it and measure it. They don't have a model of it, so they scratch their heads. My theory, I don't scratch my head. I think I've got a model that explains it and accepts it, and it doesn't conflict within my theory. So my theory started at the largest scales. And, you know, if all your theory did was, you know, explain gravity, that'd be a lot. My theory also unified the four forces. That's a lot. My theory also, you know, made predictions about a black hole and about the speed of light slowing down. That's a lot. But now, in the quantum world, in the world of the atom and subatom, I realize that, you know, this is where my theory eventually will start, you might say. Eventually, I will be able to describe that smallest world effectively. And I tried with the recent co-soul called The Atom, the seventh in that series called The Atom. I certainly make some good starting points on that, but I'm getting more. More is going to come out. So this guy, the 101 Quantum Questions, has been really good because he just lays the field bare. Quantum physics, on the one hand, sort of makes sense. You know, it is physics of the smallest sizes, and why not? But on the other hand, it kind of goes off the deep end as well. And so I look forward to replacing it. My rewatch of the week was Shuttle Discovery's Last Mission. This is whether this is PBS or whether this is Discovery Channel or whatever. The Shuttle Discovery, the Discovery was the original first shuttle, and it made it through to the end, unlike two of the others. So this was a story of its final trip to the Smithsonian, and then highlighting the features, the best points of its 30-odd missions over the years. Really amazing. The people that are involved in the shuttle program are amazing. I still think NASA is a total scam and a total waste of money. And for that matter, the shuttle is a near total waste of money. You know, these boondoggles and pork bellies and whatnot, they get started and then they get maintained because people are benefiting by them, right? No one within NASA wants to stop the shuttle, wants to stop any part of NASA. They're making too much money from it. But an amazing program, an amazing machine, really just worth watching, really, you know, inspirational. Okay, my poor watch of the week was a movie called Joe. I think this had Nick Cage in it. Just a very dark movie. Violent and dark movie. So let's look at the director and the writer. The writer was Gary Hawkins. So, you know, if something is really violent, you look for the one quality in the name. So the writer is Gary Hawkins. Gary, 156. So there's the one right away. Hawkins, 134. There's another dose of one. When you add the two together, one destiny. So this writer is this tough as nails type guy. Very one-ish guy. He's created a very violent, one-ish movie. What about the director? Does he soften things up? David is his first name, 134. There's the one again. Last name, Green, 134. And when you add them together, 268 total. But the director goes as David Gordon Green. When you add all that together, you get 551. Hell for a total and a one destiny. More violence. So it's no wonder this movie is really, this is unusual. The writer and the director, even though they have wildly different names in terms of their letters, they have almost identical names in terms of their numbers. and they both have just about the maximum amount of one. And as a result, this movie was, it was really unredeeming and really dark and violent. And, you know, it's one of those ones at the end of it, why did you watch that? Well, they love this kind of stuff, right? Because they want us to be saturated with violence. You know, in Europe, they don't censor the sexual stuff, they censor the violence. But in America, all the violence, we are so raised on it, we just accept it. We watch it, we accept it, we have nothing to say. Eh, it's not bad, you know. That's what the average comment would be at the end of the movie. Yeah, it's not bad. It's okay. I've seen better. And you just don't realize the brainwashing effect there. My cool thing of the week was the Toyota iRoad. Have a link for it. It's a car/motorcycle, you know, two wheels in the front, one in the back. The cool thing with this is that it's designed to lean, and it, you know, it takes a sort of a complicated design to allow that. But as Top Gear demonstrates, when you have these three-wheel cars, they tip over really easy. But they tip over in part because they don't lean. And you know, also, you clearly need to put smarts into the car so that it's limited in what it can do. In other words, the car senses what speed am I going, how much lean is being requested, is it safe? You know, there are some vehicles that limit and detect this stuff and limit it. I'm trying to think at the moment, I'm drawing a blank, but there are some vehicles that they stop you from doing something that could be dangerous. And once you start adding that stuff in, you can take vehicle designs that are otherwise kind of potentially dangerous and you can make them safe. Anyway, this Toyota iRoad is a pretty cool car. Hope it works out. Uncool, Apple's Devious YouTube album giveaway is even worse than spam. So the Songs of Innocence YouTube album. I guess Apple did a deal with YouTube and they put it on your player, but they put it in there as in some special capacity, so it's like a sale or something like that, so you can't get rid of it. If you delete it, it will come back. It's like you bought it, so that when you bought it, it's always part of you kind of thing. And this created a real hue and cry, because it, you know, there was like some rapper who came out and said, like, it's kind of, you know, ridiculous or arrogant of them to think that I want to listen to you two. Anyway, Apple sort of relented and took it out. But it all sort of backfired. The games the big boys play. You know, there was a time when YouTube was cool. One of the YouTubes. For some reason, my memory is just really foggy. I just don't feel sharp this morning. I was up a little late last night, and then maybe I didn't sleep quite as well as I normally would. Oh, yeah. I was trying to remember the name of the U2's song. There's one I really like the live version of. It's called Desire. And it's just a good song to play live, let's just say, put it that way. But, I mean, U2, you know, for a while there was sort of dominant and popular and whatnot. But face it, U2, no one cares. We've moved past you. Of course, they sense that, and now they want to sort of legislate themselves back into popularity. Oh, dear. This feels like a shorter than normal Floydcast, but that's the way it goes. There's a lot of different stories there. That's good. Now I'm searching for my quote of the day. Well, maybe this is appropriate on a couple of levels. Here's the quote. Those who do study history are doomed to stand helplessly by while everyone else repeats it. There's a lot of truth in that. What it's basically saying is, you know, those who are more rational are going to end up being on the sidelines, and they're going to watch everyone else be irrational. Those who are analytical and research things and come up with cause, come up with well-researched papers, are going to be largely bypassed by people who don't care. They just want another beer, they want to watch another football game or play another round of video games. Or there's so much repetition of unhealthiness in the world, like war. War is repeated, it's unhealthy. And that's where it becomes like a personal challenge, where the more you study and research and think, the more aware you are, the more it's kind of painful, right? Where you watch people making mistakes, you watch people drinking fluoride. I have some clients, you know, they take fluoride pills and supplements, and you watch that. And I don't express an opinion about it because I'm not paid to do that. That's not part of my job. And they don't ask me. But watching that is hard. Seeing those things purchased and given to kids, to children, that's hard. Children on cell phones. I mean, it will be just a short number of years and we will be watching the cancers, and it's going to be horrific. Maybe they don't really need another war, because it's the cell phone war, it's the Wi-Fi war, the radiation war. That's going to do all the killing they need. But then they make money directly from war. They don't necessarily make money directly from killing you, right? Because, although, admittedly, with the Obamacare, they forced us all to get medical plans. So they're going to when we were starting to get our illnesses and going to the doctors for our cancers, they, the 1%, are, among other things, doctors and lawyers. They are going to be getting lots of business, so their practices are going to grow and they're going to make lots of money from it. So I guess there is some degree of profit from it, but nothing compares to war, right? War is the ultimate profitable business. Because you loan money, and the money turns into bullets and bombs, and you drop the bullets and bombs, and they blow up, and then now they're worthless. It's like taking dollar bills and throwing them in a fire, right? And the bank happily loans you that money because they know that you can't pay it back. They know that they will seize assets and power in exchange for that money. And the bank printed the money in the first place. Do we really expect banks to not be behind wars? Do we really expect that? You have to abolish the banks. You have to abolish the private printing of money. If it isn't governments printing the money, bad things are going to happen everywhere in your society, without a doubt. That's what history teaches us. So this has been Floyd Maxwell, JustThinkIt.com, doing a Floydcast number 34 for October the 6th, 2014. Good luck with your life. Take care.